everyone, and welcome to Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. I'm Meredith Carey, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Lolly Arakoglu.
Hello.
Today, we're joined by Jen Gotch, founder and chief creative officer of Bando, and author of The Upside of Being Down, How Mental Health Struggles Led to My Greatest Successes in Work and Life, out March 24th. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, that was so...
I don't think I breathed.
That was impressive. And also, I will say, there have been times where I've been asked to read the entire title, including subtitle, and I was just like, I can't. It's just The Upside of Being Down. But I watched you go through it quite gracefully. I was like, oh man, she's going for the whole thing.
Well, speaking of this book, what made you feel like it was the right time to write this book?
That is a good question. So my editor actually approached me in 2015, and that was not the right time. I felt like I was too consumed with Bando. And then we spoke several times over the next 3 years. And then I think it was late 2018, we had been back in touch, and I was like starting to feel like maybe this would be the time. And my friend Busy was writing a book, and we were talking one day, and she was like, my editor, Lauren. She just said, like, my editor, Lauren. I was like, Lauren Spiegel? And she's like, yes. And I'm like, oh my God, that's the editor that wants me. I was like, I think it's time. Like, it felt like kismet. So I said yes, and I feel like I'm very big in trusting timing and like leaning in when you get a sign like that, and if you're not feeling that way, not, even though it felt like it would be cool to write a book in 2015, like I'm really glad. So that is the long answer to the short question.
You know, I think this is something people often think about because writing a book is such a massive undertaking. Mm. When you sat in front of that blank computer screen for the first time, how did you take the steps to start to work through everything you wanted to write about?
I mean, I was in front of a blank computer screen for many months. In fact, we shot the book cover. I had not written a word, and I was like, is this a good idea? So I actually read a lot about writing and tried a bunch of different, you know, tried the schedule thing, tried to force yourself, you know, write whatever, even if it's not great. I mean, there was an outline, so I sort of went in knowing what I was to write about. But I think one day I just, my brain is one of those, like, it's like a rebellious teenager, and it just, it's like, I'll write when I want to write. I'll give you that information whenever I'm ready, even though I was at the keyboard. And then one day it just sort of started and kind of went from there. And honestly, it was like these little spurts. I was not the type of author that was from 9 to 12 every day diligently writing. So it was a painful process.
Well, and I feel like a lot of the things that you're writing about are not easy things to write about. Because one of the first stories that you write about is your first travel-related anxiety attack in an airport. What was that panic attack like? And, you know, going forward, how has travel anxiety really affected you in the years since?
I mean, decades and decades of travel anxiety. I feel like I'm much better now. But, you know, that was probably early 90s when that happened. And so there was no access to information. I mean, there was not really an internet yet. So I don't think I knew what was happening. I mean, anyone that struggles with anxiety knows that like those fears feel very real and very legitimate. So I, you know, on a cellular level felt like I was going to die if I get on this airplane. So I was just consumed with that thinking, like so much so that my parents took me home and then I ended up driving back to college. And then, you know, over the next 20 years, you know, I moved across the country from my family, so I would travel home. Then I was a freelance stylist, traveled a lot. And the anxiety sort of evolved. Like for a long time, I just was scared to get on a plane. I was certain that it was going down. And I ran into a friend at the Chicago airport. She saw that I was like about to get on my last flight ever. And, you know, I said it to her and she's like, do you know how much more dangerous it is driving in LA than getting on this plane? And I was like, man, I never thought about it like that. And I'm one, like, if you can give me a fact, I can shift my thinking. So, so then I was totally cool on the airplane, and my anxiety shifted to everything that it takes from booking a ticket. Like, am I picking the right one? To what time am I calling a car? To packing? To am I getting to the gate? Am I getting through security? What's going to happen if I take my shoes off? What's going to happen when I get on the plane? Is the overhead bin going to be full? Like, it just was really, really uncomfortable. I mean, I still traveled. I know a lot of people struggle with travel anxiety and actually miss vacations and lose jobs. And so I was very, like, determined to work through it. But, I mean, I had a lot of Xanax during that time. And then I sort of just made a conscious effort probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, that I wanted to relieve myself of this thinking, because I had sort of come to understand, like, how much our minds and our egos are actually lying to us all the time, and that I could just thank my thoughts for being there, but that I did not need them and I was not in any danger. And so that helped me a lot. I mean, I still had some anxiety traveling here, obviously, because there's a pandemic and you know, and that was just creating a lot of, like, anxiety in general. Just being at the airport, you could just feel it. But I feel like I'm 85% better. So
you were talking about, you know, thanking your thoughts and saying, okay, cool, thanks for being here, now get out. What other things have helped you keep that in check? You know, you do have to travel so much, and you're coming up on a really big book tour. Yes. And a lot of more travel. Like, how do you prep so that you feel more in control now?
Yeah, I think packing in advance really helps. You know, sort of understanding what are the things that can trigger anxiety for me, just generally, and, like, 24 hours out, just avoiding anything, like not having too much caffeine, not, like, broaching any difficult conversations, packing so I feel like I'm prepared. I mean, I used to want to weigh my luggage before I went, but I've let go of some of that stuff. I think one of the big keys for me was just, like, leaving really early for the airport, because I'm actually very comfortable to just sit at the gate. Like, I can see the gate. I feel great. So, well, that's like a little poem. That might be a start of a rap song about travel anxiety. I'll get back to you guys about that. So yeah, I think it's just, like, being aware of those things and then honoring that, because then sometimes it's like, do I want to go 2 hours early to the airport? And I just feel a lot better. And then also TSA pre-check, like, really changed a lot of my experience. So those are the things.
So it sounds as a lot of it is knowing yourself.
Yes.
And being able to kind of be one step ahead of yourself.
Yes, yes.
Before you get to the airport.
Yes.
Beyond that, obviously, you're also planning trips that are both for work and also vacations. Mm-hmm. What sorts of vacations do you take to help assuage that anxiety?
I feel like it's funny to be on a travel podcast and say, I feel like I don't consider vacations that often. Most of my travel outside of work is to go home to visit my family in Florida, which is clearly a vacation, but because you're visiting family, it's like, how do I identify this trip? Because emotionally, there may be times where it's not a vacation. That's really my backup. You know, I always know that if I need to schedule a trip there, it's most likely going to be sunny for part of the time. I can dip myself in the ocean, because I can't really do that in California because it's very cold in that ocean. So yeah, I think that's the only thing. I think probably because travel has been such a trigger for me for so long, the idea of imposing that on myself to go somewhere, you know, so I think it's also got a house in the desert. And so that's a 2-hour drive.
Where in the desert?
In Joshua Tree. So, yeah, it's, like, amazing. So I guess that's sort of, like, I mean, it's a getaway. I feel like vacations involve, like, packing a suitcase and boarding something.
I feel like using time off for yourself,
yeah,
is in and of itself a vacation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I feel like, Jen, you're not the first person to say this, where, you know, you'll be like, you know, where do you travel for vacation? And they're like, oh, well, I don't actually really travel, but then I'm gone 10 months of the year for work. And I'm like, so you travel all the time.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of, like, make these rules for like what a vacation is and isn't?
No, certainly. Well, we talk at Bandeau about mental vacations. So, I mean, if we're going to speak in those terms, I take a lot of vacations. Just most of them are like in my car or on my couch or in my bed. But certainly feels like a vacation.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We've talked a lot on this podcast and between each other about how important it is to and healthy it is to like actually take all of your days, even if you're not going anywhere. Why do you or do you take all of your vacation days or your time off?
So I'm in a unique situation where I still haven't signed the employee handbook at Bandeau. So I don't know that I necessarily have to. I don't think anyone keeps track of me. And also, just to reiterate, like the not vacation thing is really not because I'm like, I have to work all the time. It just like, for some reason, that never stuck in. But for many years, I didn't take any time like for anything other than work. So like the idea of any kind of a vacation was just off the table for me. So I feel like, and I think this is a huge symptom of business people, really anyone who takes their career seriously, that it's almost like an impediment to work to take a vacation, or well, if I do that, then I won't get this done, or this, I'll, you know, I feel like everyone feels kind of indispensable at work, which I mean, in lots of ways, you know, to the 85% you are, but like everyone should be able to take that. But I think like really what I ended up realizing it was making me very sick and very like mentally and emotionally unwell to like never unplug, because there were times where I was taking a quote unquote vacation like to my parents' house, but I was in front of the computer the whole time. And so I think that I agree. It is the most important thing. I really went from as a boss like being like, please don't ever leave, to now I'm like, oh my gosh, go have so much fun. Don't look at your emails. I'm not going to email you, you know? So I feel like everyone's sort of feeling that that is not an indulgence. It's actually like a necessity to stay productive and healthy.
You know, you mentioned there was a time where as a boss, you didn't necessarily see the value in both yourself and your employees taking those days. What was the turning point? What kind of shifted that thinking?
I think it's like a lot of what I was just saying, that I started to see first for myself, what that was doing to me. And like, certainly it's one thing when something's happening to you, but the thought of it hurting someone else almost strangely takes priority, which is a backwards way that we all feel. But, and then I think a lot of it was just this general fear of missing out on something or not getting the work done, or that without the team assembled, what if they never come back? Like there was just so much fear around the early days of Bandeau, not in a way that was like palpable, but it was just very low lying. And so I think I just, the lack of control with like not having the team set and maybe missing something was just too scary for me. I mean, now I'm completely on the other side of that, because I dipped my toes in to that water to see like, what does it feel like? Do the walls come crumbling down? Nope. Nothing's ever happened. Like it's always been fine. So
you talked about that trip home that was like really stuck with you, that you ended up writing about in the book, about busyness and your dad coming in and trying to talk to you and you not being able to focus, and him being like, you're on vacation. What are you doing still being in front of the computer? and how busyness is this like kind of facade that impedes on personal time and relationships. You know, we kind of touched on this earlier, but how has your relationship with busyness kind of changed even on those vacations home?
Sure. Well, my when I take vacations now, my parents are like, do you have any, you don't have anything to do? Like, I feel like they were suffering from some sort of PTSD for many years. I mean, now they're sort of like, yeah, we get it. You don't work on vacation. But again, it all sort of circles to the fact that it's so detrimental that it actually works in the reverse of what we think, like, because I think we're equating busyness to productivity and success. And the reality is it could be the thing getting in your way. It's just that everyone has sort of gotten on board with this idea that like the more powerful and the more successful you are has to equal that you're that busy. And like I've been saying a lot, I realize that people are always start sentences to me. I know you're really busy, but, and I'm just like, I'm actually not, like, I'm actively not busy now because I didn't find that big of a difference in my productivity if I was like having healthy boundaries with workload versus not. And I'm much happier this way.
In a previous episode, we talked to Lisa Lutoff-Perlo, who's the CEO of Celebrity Cruises, and she brought up this point about how women need to stop worrying about trying to do everything. Yes. And I think we feel a pressure. We feel that to prove that we're worthy of the role that we're in, we have to show that we're working as hard as we possibly can all the time. Would you agree that women in particular have a problem with busyness?
I mean, I primarily work with women, so I feel like it may be something that also carries over to men, but I almost think that it, at least for me, my personal thing is I'm not trying to prove anything to anyone. Like, it's just the way I operate. It has more to do with like my own holding myself to a ridiculous standard of perfection or something. But I also think that women sort of have the ability to do a lot of things at once in a way that maybe men are wired different. I mean, just reading Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, there's actually like scientific evidence that like we are here to serve different roles. And I think like here we are with the opportunity and the ability. And I mean, like most of the women I work with just have an incredible work ethic and are like excited about what they're doing. So I feel like my lens on it is a little bit different, but completely agree that we're all doing too much collectively.
When you talk about taking those kind of like mental vacations, even if it's in your car, mm-hmm. in your bed, what does that look like when you're taking kind of like these mini breaks mm-hmm. from your day-to-day life?
I mean, unplugging, which is obviously a common thing that people are trying to do now. I do a lot of breathing, meditating, and it's not like I go in for 3 hours. You know, I think it's just like remaining very aware of what my intention is in the moment, that it's not like, well, I'm going to go numb myself with like TV and food. You know, like this is like a time that I'm actually using to recharge, or like I use the desert for that now because energetically it's just different there. So it's like very relaxed, just the air is more relaxing. And I think like for me, the car driving is like very relaxing for me. And I feel like our brains do, like parts of our brains shut down to just like focus on the driving, and then it just like allows all of these other more interesting thoughts to bubble up. And all of that feels like what I would want to be doing on a vacation as well. Like, so I'm not poolside with a drink, but like I'm sort of just trying to get my like mental, emotional, physical state to mirror that.
Driving is one of the biggest things that I miss living in New York because of the time it gave me every single day to be on my own. And I was doing an interview with Sophia Rowe a couple of weeks ago, and she was just took this 3-week road trip through Mexico by herself. And she's like, I've never had as many sad cries and happy cries mm-hmm. in the car alone, and like opened the door and been like, okay, cool. Like, we have done this mm-hmm. and now I'm moving on to my next activity. She said it was just like the driving part of it was as important as the trip itself.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, as someone who lives in LA and like have had up to like hour and a half, 2 hour commutes for years at a time, it's and I don't believe in resisting stuff like that because it's like, well, this is your deal. I feel like there's just like notes and notes and emails and voice memos from like what was coming through during that time. So I'm sorry you don't get to drive.
I know. Well, that's
also cool.
Yeah. It's pros and cons. It means I have to prioritize road trips whenever I'm traveling on my own.
Yeah, that's fun.
I think one problem that I have, and I know I think a lot of people do, is that when it comes to taking sort of a personal day and just having like a sort of mental health break, often you don't decide to do it until you really need it. What's your advice for sort of preempting that and actually kind of breaking into this kind of mindset of being like, I am going to book this really far in advance and I know I'll need it when I get there?
I think even if you can get ahead of it for a week, but what I have found just in general for like personal and professional life, like building self-awareness and emotional intelligence has allowed me to do everything that I've been articulating to you to sort of like have those measures to protect myself. So I think, and also for me, because I've struggled with mental illness for so long, that like you really do start to take it quite seriously if you want to be up and operational and succeeding. And so, so I feel like getting in touch with your thoughts and your body, and then also paying attention to those patterns. So maybe like when you do have that emergency mental health day, like sort of look back and be like, what led to this? Is it like, is it a full moon? Did I just have like 2 weeks full of meetings? Was there a big project? Do you know, like, is it seasonal? Like, I feel like there's so much information, in retrospect as well, that you could just, rather than feeling bad about it, just apply it to the next time. But I think also just like at 48, I've had a lot of experience with all of it. So I'm just like more practiced on figuring it out. But I think just even just stating to yourself that you're going to make it a priority changes your relationship to it immediately. Like, I think you find that you're actually, you know more than you think you know about yourself.
Other than just talking to yourself, you've talked to a lot of other people, be it on Instagram or on your podcast or through the necklaces at Bando, about mental health and mental health struggles. Why has it been so important for you to talk about your travel anxiety at the airport, your ADD, everything else that comes with being you, so publicly?
I've never had that filter. I didn't know that I would find a way to use that to such an advantage, but I don't think it started out intentionally. And I feel like when I look back, I was looking back the other day, I'm like, when was I starting doing that? Because I always thought it was like a few years, but it was actually like 2014 or 2013 that I was like starting to like talk about those things openly. And I think like, at first it was really for me, you know, to just sort of get it out. And because I didn't have that barrier of like feeling shame or embarrassment, it just like for some reason made the most sense. I mean, it to most people that doesn't make any sense, but it made a lot of sense to me. And then I think over the years, the feedback that I have received, I mean, to say that it feels like a responsibility makes it seem negative, but like, I understood more that like what I'm able to do is not a common thing, and it is something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable to put themselves out there in that way, and to know that like if I'm just myself talking about the things that I'm happy to talk about and it's helping people learn about themselves or feel less alone, or you know, it's like, how would you not do that? And I think like ultimately that's part of my purpose. And so I think like anyone who has the luxury of like plugging into their true purpose, it's like there aren't decisions that you're making, like you're just doing it.
How do you feel like since you started talking about it on Instagram and elsewhere, the conversation around mental health has changed?
You know, I exist in a bubble. I'm becoming more and more clear of that. So I feel like the conversations in my world are very open. Like, I feel like a lot of the stigma has been removed. we work with Bring Change to Mind, who's a nonprofit that deals with like destigmatizing mental health issues. And I did their student summit. And so it was like high school students. And the way that they were able to speak to me, even on a microphone in front of hundreds of other peers, about their mental illness was baffling. But then I'll talk to someone who's just works at a corporate job or whatever, and it's like, oh, it still holds all of those things. So I think like if you're around me personally or like in my orbit or have followed me, or I mean, people stop me on the street and tell me very personal things like right out of the gate, and I that does not feel like an imposition. So if I didn't know anything about the world that lies outside of like what I can see, I would be like, it's great, everyone's fine with it now. We're all talking about our anxieties openly and there's nothing to be ashamed of and we all feel that way. But when I look like outside of that, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
When it comes to talking about it and having these conversations, that also, I imagine, it extends to the people who you are traveling with. Mm. and we recently had a question for our advice columnist, Megan Spirell, from a woman who was traveling for her sister's 40th birthday. And her sister has social anxiety and a deep fear of flying. And this woman wanted to know how she could help her sister enjoy herself on this sort of once of a lifetime trip.
Mm-hmm.
What's your advice for those who are traveling with someone who's suffering mm-hmm. from travel anxiety and can help them and provide the support that they need?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I would say, honestly, if someone is in an airport having an anxiety attack, and like this is how they operate for that time, there's actually not that much you can do to like alleviate that. Like sometimes you have to just like get through the whole thing. But I have found the more stable that you can feel, and like maybe less about trying to actually fix something and just being there for them and sort of just letting them know that and not needing to like really dig in and ask questions. And certainly not, I mean, I've definitely traveled with people that are like, what's wrong with you? It's fine. And I'm like, well, that, I mean, it makes me a little mad. So I forgot about my anxiety for a second. So I guess you could do that. You could just like punch them in the face and then they would stop having anxiety. But I find like with any sort of like mental health issue, and you have a loved one or someone that struggles, like, if you can be informed, I think it just puts it in a different context where you have this understanding that it's not just the symptoms, that there's so much behind the symptoms. And so I do think it's not necessarily about like serving up solutions, but just like not being pulled into the reaction. You know, like my ex-husband was as anxious a traveler as I was, and that didn't always pan out for us. Although sometimes it just made one of us step up and be like, I'm going to be the one that makes this okay. But I think when I travel with people that are just like cool with whatever, that helps me. I mean, now I just try and be that person for myself, because then I always have her.
Can always rely on yourself.
Yes, I most of the time, unless I'm really drunk, and then I can't rely on myself.
Are there any women in particular? I know that Lolly and I both have like specific women that we love to travel with. Is there anyone that you really like driving with or flying with that you feel like is your travel person?
That is so interesting. Well, it's not a woman. Like, I travel a lot with my brother, so and he's great because he's as chill can be. But I have to say, I travel by myself more. I can't even think. I mean, I feel like Busy is probably the last person I traveled with, and that was fun because we were going somewhere for her birthday and just drank champagne, and she's very chill too. I mean, she doesn't, the airport's not a trigger for her. So yeah, I think I'm still the woman that I like to travel with the most.
I love that.
I want that on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Hey, let's write that down, because we need more. We're running out of phrases. I'm like, can we slow down here?
I will buy it. Yeah. Put me down as your first customer.
Usually if I tell them there's one sale, they will go into printing thousands.
So check Bandel. Yeah. For that t-shirt soon.
Yes.
That feels like a really good place to wrap up, if people want to buy your book, which I am not going to re-say the full title, but no, you can find it at The Upside of Being Down, where can they buy it and when?
So it comes out March 24th. I'm not sure when we're going live with this podcast, but you can obviously order it prior to that. I would say put the title into your search engine and see what comes up. The other thing I would say is there's a little place called Amazon that is absolutely selling it, but it's being sold in lots of places, both digitally in real life and on Bando.com starting April. So
perfect. And where can people follow you on the internet?
I'm just at Jen Gotch on Instagram. That's probably the best. Although I'm trying to figure out TikTok. I know. That's the best place to find me for now.
You can find me at Lale Hannah. And I just wanted to make a quick Women Who Travel plug. This March, we are launching a brand new column called I Deserve This, which will be exploring all the conflicting emotions around spending time and money on yourself. And part of the column is that we want to hear from you. So if you have a story you want to share about traveling for yourself or with yourself, tag us on Instagram or email us at womenwhotravel@cntraveler.com. We can't wait to hear your stories.
And you can find me at Oh Hey There Mare, and you can find Women Who Travel stories at womenwhotravel.com, and you can find a story that we did last year with Jen at cntraveler.com. I will make sure to link it in the show notes. We will talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.